Hello, friends. Welcome to episode 11 of Ray Keating's Authors and Entrepreneurs Podcast. I have a special, very musical guest who I will tell you about in just a moment. First, in terms of introduction, I'm Ray Keating, your host, the author of the Pastor Stephen Grant novels, which are available at Amazon.com in paperback and for the Kindle, and signed books over at RayKeatingOnline.com. And by the way, we're actually running a sale right now because we're waiting for the next Pastor Stephen Grant novel, Reagan Country, to be published. So it's a great time to get on board, get someone else on board, or just get caught up on all seven books. In addition, I'm a nonfiction book author. You can check out Chuck versus the Business World, Business Tips on TV, based on the TV show Chuck. It's jam-packed with tips for your career and business. I'm also a columnist and an economist. For good measure, I taught MBA students for 10 years about entrepreneurship, innovation, the economy, and assorted management topics. And while this podcast is mainly targeted at readers and book lovers in general, authors, aspiring entrepreneurs, everybody is, of course, welcome to tune in. Now, very pleased to have Chris Ullman as my guest. Chris is one of the leading public relations experts in Washington, D.C. I had the good fortune to work with him during my, first real step into the world of public policy, which was, let's just say, more than a few years ago. But there's more. Chris is a whistler. In fact, he is a four-time international whistling champion. And he is in, get this, the Whistling Hall of Fame, along with one of my favorites, Bing Crosby. And if that were not enough, his new book is titled Find Your Whistle, Simple Gifts Touch Hearts and Change Lives. And folks, it is a wonderful read. So as you're listening to this, head over to Amazon.com and please purchase the book. Chris, my friend, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Ray. Thank you for having me.
I'm so glad we were able to do this. So I'm going to dive right in. Before we get to your journey, though, as a whistler and author of this book, tell the listeners a little bit about your journey, if you will, in the world of Washington PR, you know, maybe the Cliff Notes version of that.
Sure. So I came here right after college in 1987. So I just hit my 31st anniversary in Washington. And so I've had eight jobs in those 31 years. And I've worked in the executive branch for George W. Bush and the legislative branch for John Kasich when he was the budget committee chairman in Clinton's administration. I was the SEC spokesman. And for the past 17 years, I've worked at a place called the Carlyle Group, which is a global alternative asset manager. So we're an investment firm, and I run the global communications. So it's been a great, wonderful career in Washington. This is a great city, despite what people say and hear about it. And I find many, many thoughtful, wonderful people here. So, and I'm one of those people trying to make this a better place.
You certainly are. And you were, I have to say this, you are one of the best people that I've ever worked with in Washington. It was a pleasure to work with you for a few years at Citizens for a Sound Economy, which no longer exists, actually. But anyway, that's a topic for another show.
Yeah, you're kind to say. And your listeners, if they haven't figured it out already, Ray is a great guy. And it's it's great to be a guest on the show.
Well, I appreciate that. So now we have the PR Cliff Notes. People want to know, well, how does someone become a whistler and eventually the international whistling champion? So hit some of the high points for us on that.
You know, people often say to me, I can't whistle. And I say to them, well, if you're an adult and you've tried for years and you just can't do it, then there's no hope for you. However, if you're like me and, you know, when you were 5 years old, you actually could whistle, and then it's like anything in life, it's what you do with it. So I was able to whistle. So at the foot of my father, who is a pretty good whistler, I would just whistle, and it became my constant companion. So throughout all my preteens and teens and then my 20s and 30s and 40s, and now I'll be 55 soon. My golden whistling anniversary is coming up. 50 nice. Years of puckering and blowing. The ultimate Washington whistleblower.
Very well put.
So, yeah. So basically what happened is that I was able to do it, and I love music. I love to practice, and I love to compete. I learned of the whistling competition I was probably around 30 when I heard about it. So I competed 9 times. I won the championship 4 times. And it's like a lot of things in life. Then how do you harness the tool? And in this case, whistling is my tool. So I've just been able to do just tons of fun things with it over time. And one of my favorite things is whistling happy birthday for people. And I'm now up to around 525 times a year.
Wow.
So it's become a ministry for me.
You know, it's funny that was when I was reading this book, and I was thinking that you funny you use the word ministry and use that in the book. And I was thinking it's a vocation for you. It really does fit that term. I don't know if you remember, you probably don't, but when we worked together, you actually whistled happy birthday to my wife over the phone. And she still remembers that to this very day. So it has an impact on people without a doubt.
Yeah. Now, it's interesting. That is a very special memory because your wife was probably one of the first people that I started whistling happy birthday for, because I actually started in the early 90s.
Right.
And that's when you and I worked together. So
right.
That's great that she still remembers it. You know, the scars are very deep, obviously. Okay.
Quite the contrary. She probably remembers that. Absolutely. And I said, of course, me with my memory, I'm trying to figure this out. And I said to her, I said, does this, you know, she goes, I remember him doing it. I remember being on the phone and it was, she really appreciated it. I said, for some reason, I think I was sitting I was down for a visit in DC, and I think I was sitting in your office and actually told you that it was my wife's birthday, and off you went. So I think that's how it worked out. But
that is how it works. And just today, this is really freaky. So Carlisle owns around 200 companies around the world, and the CEO of one of those companies, today is her birthday, and a colleague asked me to call her, and I don't even know this person. So I called her up, and she was very suspicious. She's like, who are you? What do you do? And I said, I'm a champion whistler. And she's like, no, really, what are you? And I'm like, no, I'm a champion whistler. And so but once I whistled for her, and this is the amazing part, after I finished whistling happy birthday, she just said, that is the best thing that's going to happen to me today. She said, that was amazing.
That's great. You've got to love hearing that, right? I mean, that's
been oh my gosh. It is so heartwarming. And this is really what the book is about, is it's this whole concept of the simple gift. Now, I'm not curing cancer. I haven't survived cancer. I haven't done anything truly heroic. All I've done is develop this very simple talent and then used it to brighten people's days. You know, I've whistled for the president in the Oval Office, and that was a wild experience. And, you know, and I whistle happy birthdays 500 times a year. I've taught 60,000 people how to whistle with the National Symphony one time here in Washington. So I'm able to take this super simple gift and kind of just use it to bring a little joy to people's lives. You know, a busy president, or there's this handicapped kid I whistle for who can't speak, but he can whistle. And we've been friends now for almost 15 years. And whistling brought us together. And
that's neat.
And I've really gotten this very powerful sense of how a simple gift can make a big impact in just one person's life. And, you know, I think we have a very hero-centric culture. You know, we love our heroes. And heroes are great, but there aren't enough heroes to solve the world's problems. And what it really takes is individuals feeling empowered to use their gifts to make a little difference. So my message is actually to think small. Don't think big, think small. Think about the power of your simple gift to just brighten someone's day, or to bring some joy or needed help to someone. So it's that's what my message is all about.
And that's what you say about you phrase it as, well, basically you're urging people to find their whistle, right? That's what you're telling people to do.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's kind of a find, develop, share. And you know, it's amazing, Ray. I've had so many people, you know, come up to me while I was writing the book, and since I've written it, who declare, I don't have a whistle. And I say, I'm like, whoa, okay. Well, I said, I bet you do. Let's talk. So we'll talk about it for a few minutes. And sure enough, you realize right away that these people do have gifts. And the key is to kind of think a little differently. So, for example, in the book, I assumed people get tired of hearing about my whistle. So I decided I would feature 10 other people whose whistles, you know, their simple gift, it's a metaphor, of course, whose simple gifts touched my heart throughout my life. So, and I could have put 100 people in there, but I gathered up 10 people, and their gifts are just so simple, but they're so special, and they run the gamut. So my mother's gift is empathy, and like her ability to feel other people's pain and to love them just unconditionally is such an amazing gift. And it's so simple, and it's had a deep impact on my life and anyone who's met her. So that's her whistle. I feature a Catholic priest who runs a homeless shelter, and I've gotten to know this priest. His name is Father John Adams. And he's dedicated 40 years of his life to serving those most in need in Washington. And that's a very, that, and his simple gift is love. Right. He loves these people. And then there's a really fun one. There's a gentleman who used to work on my team in the government for the Securities and Exchange Commission. And his simple gift is making the best carrot cake in the world. And it tastes good. It smells good. And even though we haven't worked together in 18 years, he still makes a carrot cake for me every New Year's Eve.
Nice.
Because I have a party. And I don't have to ask. A week before, he calls me up and he still calls me boss. And he says, boss, are you ready for your cake? And I say, absolutely. So he doesn't have to do that. He's retired. I'm not his boss anymore. But he does it out of love. He does it because it's his special thing. And it brings me just this huge joy. I just love this cake. And people who come to my party devour it. And so for people who are listening, you say, well, you know, what's my gift? And I say, well, I don't know what your gift is, but that's the whole key is go, you know, find it. Think small. Think about how you interact with other people and then pay attention to that. And what do people react to? And how do your gifts touch other people's lives? And for some people, it's very obvious, but for some, it's a little less obvious. And so that's why I want people to think about what they are capable, because they are. They are capable of actually making another life better. And think of that. Right. Think of that responsibility. It's really incredible. And so it gets me really fired up. I love this message, and people are responding really well to it.
Well, it comes through loud and clear when you read the book, and it's very powerful what you're talking about in terms of, you know, things that often seems small, but it can make such a tremendous difference in people's lives. And it's and some of it's big, but you know, it's a powerful message, and it's delivered quite well. I said to you before we started the show that you know, of course I'm behind usually on everything, but you made it.
Aren't we all?
Yeah, your writing is very engaging, and it made it very easy to sit down and, you know, just kind of get lost in it for a while and in these stories. And it's a very powerful book. It's very well done.
Thank you.
You mentioned, you know, we don't want to give away too much, but you mentioned whistling for President George W. Bush. So give us a little more on that. What was it like to whistle in the Oval Office?
It is the pinnacle of all of my crazy whistling stories over these, you know, 50 years of whistling in different settings. But the Oval Office was definitely the wildest. And the way it came about was, so his chief of staff at the time, his name was Andy Card. And a friend of mine worked for Andy and said, hey, his birthday's coming up. We'd like you to come in to the party and whistle for Andy Card. And now I worked in the executive office of the president, but not in the orbit of the president. I didn't work directly for George W. Bush. I was a few layers removed. But I said, sure, I'm happy to go and whistle for Chief of Staff Card. So I did that. And it was, and then a couple of days later, I was talking with my boss, who is the director of Office of Management and Budget. And he said, hey, the president was asking about you at the senior staff meeting this morning. And I thought, well, that can't be a good thing. How is they, you know, when you're a spokesman, as I am, you know, you're one bad quote away from losing your job. So, you know, the last thing you want to do is call yourself out to the president. Anyway, so I said, well, what? Why does he care about me? And he said, oh, he heard about your whistling and thought it was cool. And I thought, oh, okay. So then like another week goes by and I, you know, we, the senior staff for at OMB, we walk into the director's office and then like out of the blue, he just says, meeting's canceled. And then he looks at me and he points and he says, Ullman, you stay. And I thought, now I'm toast. This is definitely the end. And then he kind of looks at me with this Cheshire grin and he says, hey, we're going to go to the Oval Office and whistle for the president. And I say, oh, come on. And he said, nope, we're going to the Oval Office. So sure enough, I went and grabbed my jacket and I quickly called my wife and I said, her name's Chris also, so it's a little weird. But anyway, so I said, Chris, it's Chris. And I said, I'm going to the Oval Office to whistle for the president. And she said, can I come? And I said, no, got to go. So we go over to the Oval Office, and it was a surreal experience. So I walk in, and Bush is at his desk. He's leaning back in his chair. He's got his feet up on the desk with an unlit cigar in his hand. And that was my first sight of the president. And so then he sees me and he jumps up and he comes around the desk and he shakes my hand and he says, who taught you how to whistle? And do you sit? Do you stand? You need some water? And I was like, whoa, dude. I said, I don't need any water. I'm moist and puckered. I'm ready to go.
There you go. Has it ever been said? I was going to say, in the Oval Office.
I bet it was never said before I said it, but we think it probably was said afterwards. If you know what we mean. Yeah. Anyhow. So the president said, well, whistle for me. So it was my first official presidential directive. And I made that classic lawyer mistake where I asked a question I did not know the answer to because I said, what do you want to hear? And he said, country music. And I was like, oh, man. I said to myself, I don't know a lot of country music. Then I pondered really fast and I came up with the ultimate song, which is the Lone Ranger song. And he said, perfect. Now, I didn't have the heart to tell him it's an Italian opera. It's by Rossini, and it's the William Tell Overture. And it goes like this. There we go.
Very nice.
That's anyway, so I whistled that, and I whistled a few more songs. And then while I was there, it was originally just the president, Mitch Daniels, the director, who's my boss, and me. And then I turn around, it's like 10 more people have walked in. It was Cheney walked in, the chief of staff, the White House counsel, two photographers, a bunch of junior staff, a secretary. I mean, it was a veritable concert going on there.
Nice.
And so it's one of those things and where, you know, when I reflect on it, over the years, I've thought, you know, it was just, you know, it's a serious job. He's very busy and it's intense. And most people are always criticizing the president. So, you know, here were 20 minutes where he just got to have a little fun. I bet no one had ever been before or since a champion whistler in the Oval Office. Right. And, you know, what an honor that was for me.
Were you nervous?
To be able to share. You know, I actually did not have time to get nervous. Okay. You know, it's exact opposite. So, for example, I've whistled the national anthem at major league sporting events like the Washington Nationals, Cincinnati Reds, Washington Wizards. And I have hours to stew and get nervous because you go to the stadium at like 3 p.m. to do a sound check, but the game isn't until 7.
Right.
So I have to sit in this room all alone for 4 hours. Like getting nervous and my lips get dry, my mouth gets dry, and I'm like, oh my gosh, it's scary. And now I've done it enough where I know how to manage my nerves and my emotions. But with the Oval Office, I had no notice. It was just boom, get in there right now and start whistling.
Right, right.
And so I think it was more anxious afterwards. Like, oh, did I embarrass you, Mitch? Or did, you know, is he happy? Or, you know, am I going to lose my job? And so anyway, all went well.
Good.
It was really amazing.
Yeah, well, you know, I can identify with that with speaking engagements, and sometimes you have almost too much time to think about it or prepare, and you can get yourself in a, you know, more nervous than if somebody just says, "Hey, why don't you come up here and add, you know, add a few points?" It's like, okay.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good example. Yeah.
You know, you mentioned, I this jumped out at me when I was reading the book, because it, you don't know, but I am a huge Cincinnati Reds fan. And I actually made Pastor Stephen Grant in my novels, because it's my world. I made him a Reds fan. And I often tell people that he's the best Reds fan in fiction. And until somebody points out otherwise, I'm sticking with that. So how did that come about? How did you tell us that quick story about doing the national anthem in a Reds game?
You know, that this is a really fun story, and it really goes to show kind of this unusual intersection between politics and Wall Street and whistling. So what happened was, I got invited by one of my Carlisle bosses to go to a public policy conference. And there's this think tank in Washington called American Enterprise Institute. And they have this, they call, I call it a gab fest down in Sea Island, Georgia every year. So I got invited to this very highfalutin event. And so at the event, so there's Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House. Now, I used to work with Paul Ryan when he was a staffer on Capitol Hill. So when I see him, I say, "Hey, Paul, how are you?" And he says, "Hey, Chris, how are you?" So we run into each other at the lobby, because he was one of the featured speakers and I was just a guest. And then he said, "Hey, Chris, how are you?" And his wife was with him, and he says to his wife, Jan, he said, "This is Chris Ullman. He's a champion whistler. Whistle for her, Chris, you know, like I'm a trained monkey," which I'm very used to, I've come to enjoy that role. I don't take offense or anything. So I whistle for Jana, and we talk and we get acquainted for, you know, 10 minutes. And all right, so they go their way, I go my way. So then that night at dinner, I get a tap on the shoulder. So this is a large dinner. There's probably 300 people at the dinner. And this young lady comes up to me and said, "Mr. Castellini would like to see you." Now, I don't know who Mr. Castellini is, but I'm saying, okay. Mm-hmm. So I follow her and I go to this table. So at the table is sitting my boss, who's a Dan Daniello, you know, a billionaire financier, sitting with Paul Ryan and his wife and this guy named Bob Castellini. So I walk up, he stands up, shakes my hand, and he says, "Whistle for me." So I still wasn't sure who he was. So I said, "What do you want me to whistle?" He says, "Well, of course, the national anthem."
Well, there you go.
And I'm like, "The whole thing?" And he said, "Well, part of it." So I whistled the finale of the national anthem. And he looks at me and he says, "Okay, you're in." And I said, "Well, in what?" And he said, "Well, you're going to whistle the national anthem at a Cincinnati Reds game." And I said, "Oh my gosh." So it turns out that Jana, Paul's wife, put the squeeze on Castellini and said, "Hey, there's this guy over here who's a champion whistler and he can whistle anything, and he's whistled for the Nationals. He needs to whistle for a Reds game." And that's how it came about. So she became my agent as a result
of
this.
Very cool. Very nice. Very nice.
So then interestingly though, and what ended up happening was, and this is the secret of PR people, is that, you know, when your boss comes back and says, you know, "Hey, I agreed to do this interview and take care of it." You know, the PR people are usually upset and they say, "Well, I'm the one who sets up the interview. The boss isn't supposed to set up an interview." So the PR people end up killing a lot of those things because they just say that's stupid and the boss should have said no, but he said yes. Well, I am confident that's what happened here, because I then got in touch with the PR people at the Cincinnati Reds company, and they were so uninterested in having me whistle the national anthem. They did everything possible to avoid having me do it. And because it was pretty clear what happened is, Castellini went to them and said, "Hey, there's this champion whistler." And I asked him to whistle the national anthem. And, you know, you could picture the look on their faces like, "Are you an idiot? Whistle the national anthem?" I mean, that would be like Roseanne Barr. I mean, screeching it. And, you know, and that's the last thing we need, is, you know, defacing the national anthem. So then I'm a PR guy, so I'm all about results. And I say to myself, "All right, how do I make this happen? I can either be upset and kind of castigate them and just, you know, trying to embarrass them into finally saying yes, or I could just be really, 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 really nice. So I was. I kept saying these super nice emails. I know you're busy, and but you know, Mr. Castellini said he'd love to have me do this, blah, 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 blah. So they finally gave in and said, all right, you can do it. So I go to Cincinnati. I pay my way both ways and all that, and I do it. So after I walk off the field with the guy who has been avoiding me all this time, and he says, he looks at me and he says, that was amazing. And I said, yeah, that's the whole point. So he is now a believer.
That's cool.
And if anyone wants to see that, it's on my website, which is chrisullman.com, chrisullman.com. And I have like my national anthems on there, and then CBS Evening News did a feature recently. So there's lots of good video on
and
there.
And you were on the Tonight Show, right, Jay Leno? Is that correct?
Oh, my God. Yeah, I was on the Tonight Show. This is one of those 15 minutes of fame. You remember Andy Warhol said everyone's going to have their 15 minutes. So I that was my 15 minutes. It was 1994. I won the international championship for the first time. And the dam just burst open. And people went berserk. I mean, I was on the Tonight Show. I was on the Today Show with Katie Couric. I did 100 radio interviews. And I was on C-SPAN for your policy wonk listeners. And I mean, you name it, I did it. I was features in the Washington Post, the New York Times. I mean, it was a wild, wild year.
Right.
And so one of them was the Tonight Show, and it was just an amazing experience. Of course, this is at the time, this is 94. This was the ultimate late night show. David Letterman fans may disagree, but this was, you know, iconic, you know, to be on with Jay Leno. And he was incredibly gracious. He didn't make fun of me, which is what I feared, that people think whistling is just silly. And, you know, it's unusual to do it at a championship level, but I am serious about it. You know, people say to me, do you practice? And I say, what planet do you live on where someone could be this good and not practice? But if anything, it goes to show the kind of the hurdles that a whistler has to get over from a credibility standpoint. But, you know, I'm good spirited about it. I try not to take myself too seriously. And, you know, one time, this is a funny story. One time I was backstage at Carnegie Hall in New York, and my boss, Arthur Levitt, who is SEC chairman, who was about to go on stage for the 25th anniversary of Louis Rukeyser's Wall Street Week show, which I'm sure you
know. I remember Louis Rukeyser's
and he was going on,
Week.
Yeah. So he was going on with Dick Grasso, who's the head of the New York Stock Exchange, and Sandy Weill, who is the top banker on Wall Street. He ran Citigroup. And so they were three of them were – we were all backstage, and I was kind of in a corner minding my own business as PR people are supposed to do. And then Arthur like just looks at me, kind of snaps his fingers and says, Chris, come here. So here I know I'm about to do another trained monkey thing. And so I walk up, and Grasso and Weill are there, and Arthur says, whistle for them. So I whistle a song, and there was easily the bizarrest reaction in my 50 years of whistling. Their reaction was no reaction. They didn't smile. They didn't laugh. They didn't say, wow, that's cool. They just said nothing. And it was so awkward. And then I realized pretty quickly what was going on, that this was just way beneath them. And I kind of skulked off and went back into the corner. And I actually had a similar experience like that with Newt Gingrich when he was Speaker of the House. I was in an elevator with him and John Kasich, who is now the governor of Ohio, but who was the budget committee chairman at that time. And they were in the midst of some, you know, budget negotiation, and Kasich goes to Newt and he says, Newt, and you know, Kasich is kind of this wiry hyper guy. He's like, Newt, Chris is a champion whistler. You got to hear him whistle. And then, so he looks at Newt and just, it's no reaction at all. And it's just the three of us and a guard in the elevator. And then, so Kasich thought maybe he didn't hear him. So he's like, Newt, he's been on the Tonight Show. He's been on the Today Show. He's whistled symphonies. Nothing. And it was just so weird. But this is what's interesting. It's like this binary reaction. Either you get it or but you don't. Or
you know, don't. In terms of your book and the people that you've whistled for, it seems like that, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like that's the exception. And the message that I got throughout much of the book was, here are people that are highly successful, reach the peak of their respective fields, but they appreciate what you're doing. I mean, is that right or is that wrong? I mean, is that the, is.
Yeah, I would say most people okay. get it. And so, for example, I met the associate conductor of the National Symphony Orchestra at a backstage event one time, and the person who introduced us said, "Hey, Chris is a champion whistler," and instantly, like, her eyes lit up, and she looked at me and she said, "Well, whistle for me," and so I whistled. I can't remember what I think I whistled A Train by Duke Ellington.
Oh, I love that.
And she was, yeah, it's a great song. And then she says, "Wait here." And then I turn and she walks like 10 feet away. And there's this man, she goes up to this man, they chat, she comes back and she said, "How would you like to whistle with the National Symphony Orchestra?" And now this is the dream wow. come true. I mean, this is astounding. And I said, "Well, let me check my calendar." Ah, yes. Okay. So it turns out that they were planning a concert only like 2 months later with where they were going to do a piece written for Whistler. And there's very little music written for Whistler, which is one of the problems of Whistler's gaining legitimacy. Okay. But and this is a march written in the 1920s by a guy named Edwin Franco Goldman, and it's called On the Mall. And it was written in honor of an event for New York's Central Park. Anyhow, so when this is performed, they usually have anyone in the orchestra or band who doesn't have something in his or her mouth whistle. Okay. So if you're playing an oboe, you cannot whistle. But if you're playing the drums or a violin or a cello, you can whistle. So then she said to me, "Well, let's have you whistle instead." So that's what we did. And it was astounding. There was 60,000 people at this concert at the U.S. Capitol. And it was totally intense. And so I whistled it. I had a little stage fright and I almost forgot my notes, but I didn't, thank God. But so it went well. And then they had me come back at the end of the concert and then teach the audience the whistling part of the song and then whistle it all together. And it was wow. amazing. Totally. To hear 60,000 or so people all whistling a tune together that they had just learned. And it's a very catchy tune. So it was,
that's one of those really moments cool. with music that, I often talk, my son is studying to become a pastor. And when you go to events where, you go to church every week, and you hope that people kind of sing, but I've gone to events where it's been essentially church laymen and pastors, and you put them in a cathedral, so there's like 200 or 300 of these people, and when they sing together, it's like, oh, this is how it's supposed to sound,
yeah, right. Very well put. Yeah.
So let's switch gears a little bit. You've talked about kind of how whistling has come into your PR work, is being a PR person helped you as a whistler, I guess, on the other end, the other way?
Oh, just hugely. And, a lot of PR is relationship driven, where you get to know journalists and you're just chatting with them. You're not necessarily pitching a story, but you're chatting about your weekend and you're chatting about this. And then you say, "Oh yeah, such and such happened," and the journalists, their ears kind of get excited, and they say, "Wow, that would be an interesting story." So that's how I got so much attention for my whistling over the years, is that I'd just be chatting with a New York Times reporter about Carlisle and our latest deal, and then there was this one guy named Kevin Roos, and he had no idea I was a whistler, but somehow it came up in conversation. And he said, "That's unbelievable." He said, we should, he said, "We're about to start a new series at the Times on kind of quirky hobbies of Wall Street executives. And he said, we already have one lined up, but he said, we want you to be the second installment in this series. And sure enough, that's what we did. And that thing has gotten thousands and thousands of views, that video they did, and they wrote an article. So that's been helpful. And my PR, you know, it's gone back and forth. They've helped each other because whistling is a very niche kind of thing. And so I've learned how do you market something that's a little unusual. And that's helped me in my day job, and my day job's helped me in my avocation with whistling. And so, yeah, it's been a great kind of – there are a lot of synergies there of what I do for a living, who I get to interact with, you know, journalists right. primarily, plus my hobby. And also I whistle happy birthday for tons of journalists right. every year. So that keeps it fresh. And now some of your listeners might be saying this guy is just a shameless self-promoter. And they would be correct.
My kids say the same thing about me, by the way. So.
Yeah. I mean, but the thing is, if it's genuine, right. I mean, I try not to be like in people's face about it. And because my kids get a little disturbed when I, like, say we're at a restaurant and so it's someone at the table next to us is having a birthday party. Like, I'll say, hey, should I go whistle for them? They're like, no, don't do that. Do not. They're like, oh, darn, that would have been fun. And however, I do sometimes walk up to strangers. There's a 92-year-old lady at church, and last weekend they actually sang happy birthday for her at Mass. And in my 55 years of living, I've never seen that happen. And I do not know this woman, but at the coffee hour afterwards, I went up to her and I said, I wanted to wish you happy birthday. And I said, I have this unusual talent. I am a champion whistler. And she said, I'm 92 years old and no one has ever done that for me. And so I got to bring, and this gets back to the whole simple gift concept. I got to bring a little joy to this senior citizen on her special day. And it just really warmed my heart. And she was delighted. Her daughter was there who was visiting from Richmond and sent me a note the other day saying, my mom just loved that. You really made her day. And think about that. You know, we have hustle bustle lives. There's a lot of divisiveness in our society right now. And Washington is not a particularly, you know, warm and fuzzy place to begin with. And it's worse now. So, you know, this is my way of saying, you know, I'm going to get beyond, you know, the partisanship and just focus on the humanity that, you know, and birthdays are a great tool for that, because what are you doing? You're honoring their life. And it's not about Democrats or Republicans or who's a liberal or who's a conservative. It's that I am glad you were born. And I don't say I'm glad you were born because you're a Republican or because of this or that. No, I'm glad you were born because God made you. And now, you know, our lives have intersected. That's what I'm trying to do. And then with my ministry, and, you know, everyone's got to do their thing with their ministry.
No, and that's, again, a powerful thing, especially when, you know, it sounds, you know, people have said it so often, but you're right. I mean, in terms of the amount of time that you and I have been in or around Washington, I think it's pretty safe to say that things are far more divisive today than certainly when I first started. And if you go back a little bit before that, and, you know, I think that unfortunately has spread out to the nation as well. So, being able to tap into those things that, you know, truly, I don't care if you're a Republican or a Democrat or so on, you know, you're a fellow human being. That's again, quite a gift. Going back a little bit to the PR, you know, this podcast is Authors and Entrepreneurs. So I think I know this answer, but let's hear from you. Do you think of yourself as an entrepreneur, and do you like the business side of writing? You know, let's talk about your book now, the business side of writing. Do you like that? Do you like that process?
Well, growing up, I exhibited some entrepreneurial type, you know, traits. So I had a lawn cutting business and raking leaves and washing cars and shoveling snow and a paper route. I always had a job. My nickname was Moneybags when I was a teenager. It was also Massapequa Fats because I lived in this little town called Massapequa on Long Island, and I was a little chubby. So I hope that doesn't offend anyone. But
you
anyway,
are a, you so are a fellow, it, you are it a fellow wasn't just Long a money. Islander, so there you go, as a
that's I am, yes. And so I've always had kind of an entrepreneurial streak, but I'm not a ferocious entrepreneur, you know, a serial entrepreneur who's laying it all on the line to start a business. I mean, that has not been my kind of my MO through life. However, I'm actually starting to, the book has gotten me pining for it, like being my own boss, the process of creating something using my own brain and my fingers and typing and you know, that process has been really fascinating to me and has gotten me excited about the whole product customer concept. That, you know, can I use my skills to produce a product or a service that people will voluntarily buy, to the extent that hopefully I, you know, I can sustain myself. Now at this point I love my day job, but you know, I'm 55 and who knows what the future holds. So I'm thinking more and more about that entrepreneurial component, and you know, thinking of ways that I can exercise it more vigorously. And I'll, you know, writing a book is challenging, it's fun, it's maddening and all that. And selling a book is all of that times five, I think. You know, it's sort of like, and you know this better than me since you've written, I think, seven or so, is that, you know, it's like retail politics. It's like running for office, is that you want to get, it's kind of this barbell on the marketing side. You have the free earned publicity, you know, when newspapers write articles about you as a politician or you as an author. And then on the other side of the barbell is you are in the trenches. It's hand-to-hand combat. You're in people's living rooms and you go to book clubs. And if someone invites you on their podcast, you say, yes, I can't wait, because that's what it takes. And it's pure entrepreneurial spirit is getting out there and making the case. And what's really fascinating, and I'm sure you could reflect on this, and some of your listeners who are writers would reflect on it quite well as well, which is that there's this fascinating juxtaposition between writing, where you're often alone in a room with headphones on, listening to music or whatever your thing is, but you're alone and you're writing hour after hour, day after day, week and year. And then you have to get it edited, so then you have to subject yourself to some third person's opinions, and then you have to get people to buy the thing, which is then requires you to get out of your darkened room where you've been writing and go out into the sunlight and make the case that people should buy this book. And wow, that is challenging. You know, I'm loving it five times more than I anticipated. I think it's the coolest thing, but it is definitely hard. And, you know, I'm a first time author. I'm a no name author. So, you know, I've sold around 4,000 books.
Good for you. That's great.
9 months. So I'm,
do you know the average book?
I'm chipping away at it.
Today sells 250 copies. Yeah.
Oh, and my gosh. Really?
You are way out of the curve. And if you go back a few years before indie publishing really got rolling, it was only 500. So whatever gauge you want to use, you're rolling.
Wow. And most of those were libraries buying the book, probably. Hey, listen, 500 libraries want to buy my book. Just give me a ring. I'm there.
But you've got the right attitude going in. I mean, I know so many writers that just dread, as you say, coming out of the room, if you will, and going out and doing the people thing to sell the books. But you've got to do that. And you've got to engage with people in all sorts of venues now, not just, as you said, in living rooms and churches and bookstores and libraries, but, you know, online and social media and so on. And that has been, you know, for myself, that's been a tremendous benefit in terms of being able to reach people through Facebook and so on. It's, but you've got to, the last guest I had on, who actually is a pastor author, he made the point of, you have to think about that part, the marketing aspect, as part, an extension of the creative process, you know, that you're now, whatever you, maybe you're writing a press release, you know, and you know all about that, but you're doing whatever you're producing. If you think of it as part of the creative process for the book, I think that probably will entice. And I think he's right. It entices people, or writers understand that and are more willing to maybe engage on that front.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think for those, you know, what's interesting is I've had a number of people who are aspiring authors come up to me and say, you know, I've got an idea and I think I'm a good writer. And I say, great. I said, but go, this is what I say to them, go to a bookstore today or as soon as possible and walk through every aisle and then say, look at all those books and say, how am I different? How am I special? Why will anyone care about what I have to say? And if you can answer that question honestly and come up with a compelling answer, then go for it. If you can't, now, I mean, I don't want to tell people you should not try, but I think pragmatism is important too. Now, for some people, it's just a cathartic process of writing, and I say more power to you, go for it. But it's a long journey to embark on if you don't have a differentiated product. And I do marketing for a living, so that's how I think. Now, I haven't sold a million books yet. You know, 4,000 is fine for a first time author, but you know, I'm going to keep going. My goal is to hit the 10,000 mark in 2018, and
You set goals at each step along the way, and you reach those goals, and you move on to the next, and that's a good way of looking at it. I think that's the way I try to look at it as well. Well, while we're on this, because I have one other question that relates to the writing process itself, but staying along this theme, do you have any other best piece of advice, or maybe two or three other pieces of advice for authors out there from your PR writing whistling backgrounds?
Yeah, I think I'm all about message delivery, or message development and message delivery. You know, I had a chance to do a TEDx talk. You know, these are the kind of the independently organized TED talks. The book came out of that project. And so when the organizer met me and said, wow, you're a whistler, you should do a TED talk. And I said, well, I'd love to do a TED talk. And then he looked at me and he said, well, what would you say? And I said, that's a good question. Let me think about that. So I spent months, literally like 3-4 months, pondering who cares that I can whistle well. And it was that process that I went through that helped me come up with the concept of finding your whistle, finding your simple gift. And that led to both a successful TED Talk, and you can go on Google, and YouTube and find it, and then led to writing the book. So what's the point? The point here is that anyone who's really interested in writing you have to really have a point. Like, what is the takeaway that readers are going to get and from what you have to say? So they have to think long and hard about what the message is, how to differentiate it, both during the writing process. And if you set it up well during the writing process, it will help you in the marketing process as well. Mm-hmm. And that's what I do in my day job. You know, I do corporate communications, and it's all about how do you understand your product. And in my case, it's an investment firm. It's the deals we do. It's the people who do the deals. They're my products. And I spend all day thinking about why will anyone care? It's that process that is good, that's critical to go through, it's really important to get constructive feedback, you know, not just from, you know, a spouse who's going to say, you're wonderful, you're awesome, you're great,
you don't know,
everyone's
going to
love you, and you're sell 100,000 books. Oh, okay. No.
She's
All right, well,
she's the editor, so she's the English major, so So she's, she's the one that, that I get, when I give the first copy to her, I said, okay, we're married, so be nice.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that, but I bet she does, you know, it's almost like she switches off her, marriage hat and puts on her editor hat, because otherwise she can't be effective. Your product won't be
absolutely. And actually, when I go out and do book sales, you know, if she happens to come along with me, I don't have to say much, because then all of a sudden she's the best saleswoman in the place. So it's really interesting to watch. Yes. Anyway, I interrupt you. Finish that thought.
Oh, I love it. Oh, well, I think having that objective feedback and, you know, opening up your mind to, you know, different possibilities, because that's the beauty of editing, is it's not done yet. The ink is not on the paper. So therefore, you still have that chance to make it the best it can be. And I think soliciting feedback from different people is really important as well, because, you know, no one person has a lock on greatness, both from the content production standpoint, as well as the editing of the content. You know, there are many ways to
achieve success. And having that editor that essentially, you know, an editor you trust is critical. And that's, you know, I learned that in the newspaper business. You know, when I wrote a column for Newsday, for a weekly column, for 12 years, and I was, as I like to say, I was the token conservative at the newspaper, and every editor was, you know, they disagreed with me on 98% of the issues, but they didn't care about that. They were just trying to make sure that I produced the best column I could produce. You know, they were, well, there you go, professional editors. But I learned in that process how valuable that is. And as you say, to be open to feedback, you know, you've got to, you have to use your brain, because not all the feedback you're going to get is going to be ideal or going to be accurate, but you have to be open to it. And that's a part of the process of growing as a writer, without a doubt. Now,
very well put.
Tell us, we'll close to finishing up here, I think. Tell us about your writing process. I always remember, you know, Brian Lamb on C-SPAN always had the question for people, you know, when do you write? Where do you write? You know, how do you write? So what's the Chris Ullman process?
Well, I have a pretty intense job. It's a global firm. So I'm on all the time for my job. So trying to find those really good pockets of time to write for my personal use was challenging. So I tend to be a morning person. So I'd wake up, you know, 4:30, 5 a.m., try to write for hour and a half, as many days as I could during the week. And then Saturday mornings, after I made pancakes for the family, nice. I would get a pass from my wife to say, all right, go sit in the study and write for 3 hours. And then I'm a very good power writer. So when we would go on vacation, and this is over a 5-year period, I would bring my laptop, I'd bring my outline. And while the family is sleeping in, you know, I'm writing for 3 hours every day during vacation. Mm-hmm. And sometimes longer, to try to just get this really good, it's almost like REM sleep. It's that deep thinking, writing, cranking stages. And then also I wrote a lot of the book on the Acela train. Now, for your listeners who don't know that, that's the faster, Amtrak train, that goes from Washington to New York. So I would purposefully take the 5 a.m. train and then write for 3 straight hours anytime I could. So I'd rather take the plane, whereas more interruption, I would take the train, put on my headphones,
listen to the same exact thing. What is it about trains? I'm not quite sure, but
I love it.
The same exact thing. Lately, I'm going down to Washington. I can't remember the last time I flew. I always do the train, and part of it, a big chunk of it, is because I just carve out writing time, and it's just wonderful.
Oh, that's great. And that's the thing. And you know, Stephen King, the great author, and I'm a big fan, said that if you do it often enough, you will get good at it. And so he attributes a lot of his success to the fact that he just wrote all the time, over and over and over again. And so that's what I tried to do, is just say, I'm going to keep writing. Now, and this was another really important thing that I did just over the past 25 years, which is write anything you can. So these have fallen out of favor, but my wife and I mm-hmm. send out an annual family letter, and it's at Christmas time, and it's our family's life okay. told from the perspective of our cat. So, and people love this thing. People like routinely say, "When am I getting the cat letter?" And I'll say, "I'll check with the cat."
So wait, let's just review here. You call people on their birthday and you whistle happy birthday, and you send them a Christmas letter from your cat.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. So we've now determined that I am weird.
I know. It's all.
And I'm friends with you. Yeah. So I found that
that's a wonderful creative writing
exercise every year. And I did it for 20 years, and I write poetry. And when I proposed to my wife, I did it in the form of a poem. And so the point is that, you find excuses to write, and it's whether it's writing your book or write anything. So you're putting words on paper, and that's stretching you from your day job writing. You know, my day job is writing news releases and message points and fact sheets and that kind of stuff. And I'm very good at it. And it's a way different kind of writing than writing a narrative type book. So over time it accumulates. And I should have mentioned this at the beginning, but having a really good outline is critical, I find, because you want to keep things flowing. You don't want to just like meander off too often. I mean, there's merit in that occasionally as part of the creative process, but you want to keep the train going down the track. And then here's my final, I'll give one final piece here, is that I actually changed my writing style, so or approach, probably a better word. So years ago, anytime I wrote a sentence or a paragraph, I wanted it to be like 95% complete on the first draft. And then, but what I found was that I was angsting over it because I kept thinking, well, this has got to be 95% complete. So then I changed my threshold to like 75 to 80% complete. And I write twice as fast now. And then I go back and edit. I was going to go back and edit anyway, but I'm finding that it's almost like loosening your brain up a little, being a little less uptight, a little less worried about every word,
I do different types of writing. I mean, I used to do newspaper columns for 20 plus years. I write some columns online. Then I do policy papers and short analysis. And, you know, you've got all these things. And then I do this fiction stuff. And what I, you know, for me, the fiction allows me to, as you say, to free up the brain, if you will, and get more creative. And I'm I'm far more likely to do what you're saying. You know, when I'm writing a policy paper, it's a slower process. I enjoy it, but it's very different. And I tend to want to have it a certain way before I move on to the next paragraph or section or whatever. But with fiction writing, I'm much more flexible and just like get that out there, get it down. And then when you come back and edit later, you know, that's fine. That works. And I find that now is leaking a bit back into my other writing, you know, columns and policy papers and so on. So it's odd. The more you do something, the better you get, hopefully. So there you go. But.
Yeah, that's great.
Any other final thoughts for us? Parting thoughts?
Yeah, I'd say ultimately, I want people to realize what they are capable of doing to make the world a better place. And so it's very much an empowerment message to just, you know, think about it. Every day from the morning the moment you wake up to the moment you go to bed, you will encounter dozens, if not scores, of people. And I want people to better embrace, more fully embrace the capacity that each of them has to make a positive impact, however fleeting and always appropriate, on the people they encounter, those scores of people they encounter every day. It's amazing. I mean, I routinely go out of my way to smile at people. It is astounding the reactions you get. You know, a lot of times you'll pass someone with just this totally impassive look in your face, and that's what you get from them. But if you look at someone in the eye, you give them a nice smile, they almost always smile back at you. And it's so pathetically simple, but it's demonstrative of the point, which is that I now touch that person's heart in a tiny, tiny way and maybe brought a little joy to someone who maybe was a little down. But the larger point is take that capacity to impact another one and then integrate it with your gift and then do it volitionally. Don't just be passive about it, but go find it, develop it, and share it. Actually go purposefully make an impact.
I like it. On the world. Chris, thank you for your whistle, both as a whistler and in terms of your outlook in terms of how to reach people and touch people's lives. It's wonderful stuff, and the book is wonderful as well. I appreciate it again. And everybody, thank please you, check Ray. Out this Chris's awesome. Website, chrisullman.com. And again, head over to amazon.com to buy Chris's fantastic book, Find Your Whistle. And what the heck, while you're there, why not grab some Pastor Stephen Grant novels in Kindle form and in paperback for all of the above. Thanks for tuning in. Please like us on Facebook at Pastor Stephen Grant Novels and at Authors and Entrepreneurs. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. And please tune in to another new podcast of mine, Free Enterprise in 3 Minutes. And again, you can listen and subscribe at iTunes. And until the next installment of Ray Keating's Authors and Entrepreneurs podcast, enjoy reading, enjoy writing, and yes, enjoy entrepreneurship. God bless and take care.